Blog Talk Radio.
Hermetic Hour for Thursday, May 31st, 2012. Tonight we feature a discussion by your host, Bill Grunion, that's myself, on the current mystery behind the U.S. failure of the major film John Carter. Now, this film was a resounding success in Russia, broke all box office records, in Europe, and Latin America, and in China. Why did it flop in the USA? Well, to understand this, we must also ask why the U.S. space program has been virtually shut down, and why the rest of the world knows more about the planet Mars than Americans do. We will look at the work of Richard Hoagland and more currently, Andrew Basagio, and the current article called True Mars in the latest Atlantis Rising issue. We'll discover that Mars has water, it has vegetation, it has atmosphere, it has life, and it has ancient ruins. And concepts of time travel and teleportation will be explored in relation to the John Carter screenplay. Now, the John Carter DVD will be released June 5th, that's just a few days from now. Keeping our speculations in mind, you can have another look and wonder why this excellent and provocative motion picture was poorly edited, ineffectually advertised, and badly reviewed. So, tune in, and we'll voyage to the real Barsoom. All right, let me qualify a few things first before we get started. Number one, I am a longtime old Edgar Rice Burroughs fan. I started reading the Mars books, and there are 11 of them, by the way. I started reading the Mars books when I was about 14 years old, and this was before they pulled them out of the children's libraries. They actually had them in the children's section of the libraries back when I was a kid, and I got them from the library, and then I managed to use my allowance, and I got a few more because Burroughs was publishing them himself. I read all the Mars books, and I just loved them. I think the Mars books were written for young adults and adults, but even when I was a kid, they were pretty much young adult fare at that time. And Burroughs originally started with the first one, Princess of Mars, in 1912, and it was published in serial form in a pulp magazine called All Story Magazine, And then very shortly after that, it was issued under the title A Princess of Mars as a book. Originally, it came out as Under the Moons of Mars. Now, just to make put a little plug in here for the book itself, Under the Moons of Mars is the title now for the first three Mars books. So you can get an hardcover from Science Fiction Book Club. You can get Under the Moons of Mars, and that is the first three. That's the Princess of Mars, the Gods of Mars, and the Warlord of Mars. And this is good reading. It's still good reading after all these years. Very exciting and very imaginative, especially for its time. Now, this Mars series of Burroughs was so important in science fiction. It really, you can say that it set the pattern for science fiction adventure for the next 50 years. And quite frankly, we owe Star Wars and Star Trek and the space operas, and then we owe them really to Edgar Rice Burroughs' John Carter of Mars. Just to give you an idea of how influential this was, Edgar Rice Burroughs, by the time the 1930s rolled around, he had about eight of these Mars books under his belt by that time, and Flash Gordon came out in King Features in the Sunday funnies, and then of course they were made into serials, as you know, into motion pictures. Edgar Rice Burroughs Incorporated sued King Features for pirating John Carter in Flash Gordon. And the only reason why they lost the suit was because so many other stories had been pirated from John Carter that it was no longer an issue. So, hey, they lost the suit. And it is true. Flash Gordon is really owes a great deal to John Carter. And also it owes something to Otis Adelbert Klein's Mars of the Moon, but that's for another program. But anyway, the original story of John Carter on Mars involved a very mysterious transition, because Burroughs, as I say, he wrote this in 1912. Now, he did have a couple of sources that influenced him. One was a book by a Hindu, written in English, about a astral voyage to Mars, astral trip to Mars, and that probably influenced Burroughs to do the jump to Mars that Carter made. And then there was another one, Lieutenant Gulliver of Mars, which was a kind of a very lighthearted, sort of a fantasy, and very light and frivolous kind of fantasy, but imaginative, and Burroughs may have been influenced by that. And Burroughs was also influenced by some of Blavatsky's ideas of Lemurian creatures, one thing or another. But regardless of all these influences, the imagination and the attention to detail that Burroughs developed in his Mars books is absolutely amazing, and it had a tremendous influence on science fiction. Now, at the time, 1912, they believed that Mars was possibly inhabited. It could be, and they were seeing what they thought were these canals, and they thought, yeah, sure, it's probably mostly desert, but it looks like they've got it irrigated, and you know, this was just a few years after H.G. Wells had done his War of the Worlds, so there was still a good possibility that there still was an active civilization on Mars. At the time, Burroughs wrote his story. And yet, at the same time, Burroughs was trying to follow the science of the time, and he knew that Mars was what he pictured as a dying world. In fact, they even, the Martians, as much as they fought among themselves on Barsoom, which is what the Martians call the planet, as much as they fought among themselves, they all cooperated with a great big atmosphere factory that they had that kept the the planet's atmosphere breathable. And in the original story, Princess of Mars, at the end, the atmosphere factory is sabotaged, and John Carter is the only one that knows the access code, and he. When everybody is falling down, and including his wife and Dejathoris and the whole court at Helium, and they're all passing out from the, and he makes it to the atmosphere factory, and he punches in the access code, and he's not sure. He gets inside the factory, and we don't really know whether or not he saved the planet or not, because he pops back to Earth, because he had made an astral flight originally to Mars. And yet, even though it was an astral flight, he ended up on Mars with his full physical faculties, including his earthly muscles, which enabled him to have almost superpowers on Mars, because the gravity's much, much less than Earth. And so this gave him tremendous agility. Now, in the original story, this was a very, very mysterious and provocative situation. John Carter, or Jack Carter, as they called him, was a former captain in the Confederate Army in Northern Virginia, cavalry captain. And he was out in the West, right after the war between the states. He was out in the Southwest prospecting for gold. And he got into this cave, and it was kind of a mysterious cave, and there was this ancient mummified Indian shaman inside the cave. It's according to the book now, not the screenplay. But he's in the cave, and he's been wounded by the Apaches, and they're closing in on him. And he passes out, loses consciousness, regains consciousness, looks down at his own body, looks up at Mars, at the planet Mars in the night sky, and whoosh, he goes through the wormhole or whatever, and the next thing he knows, he's sitting on his in the Martian desert. Wondering where he is, what's happened, and what have you. Now, the screenplay, the modern screenplay, dealt with this in a different way. They did the same thing, but they did something really ingenious. Now, I want to explain before we get into this, talking about the modern version here, the film version, that if you go to Wikipedia, which we all do, and you go to Wikipedia and look up John Carter the film, and they have a 17-page dissertation on everything about this film that you could imagine that they're going to tell you about, and all of the history of all of the development of it and everything else. And reading through all of this, you get a pretty good idea of what they were trying to do and what happened, but some of the major questions as to why the film failed in the United States and yet was very successful in Russia and China and Latin America, and why did it fail in the United States? Why was it a box office flop? That is not explained. However, to get back to the film itself, the screenplay that Stanton and his colleagues came up with, the screenplay was ingenious, and they updated Burroughs, and they came up with more modern more modern and even more imaginative in modern terms, method for getting him out of that cave in the Arizona desert and getting him to Mars. And what they did, but first I need to explain that the film, John Carter, the film, is a squeezed up version of all three books, of all three of the books that are now issued under the title Under the Moons of Mars. This is The Princess of Mars, The Gods of Mars, and The Warlord of Mars. It squeezes elements from all three, and so they're trying to tell a huge, huge epic, and they're trying to do it in 2 hours, and that's part of the problem with the film, is the fact that they're trying to do all of this. Now, those of you who are into science fiction films, as you recall, this is what happened to Dune. When David Lynch did Dune for Dino De Laurentiis, it was a four-hour film. But when they released it, they cut it down to 2 hours or less. And at this point, David Lynch said, I don't want my name on this thing, because nobody's going to understand what it's all about. You've made a hash out of it, and I don't want my name on it. So it came out, the first version of Dune came out. It wasn't directed by David Lynch. It was directed by Alan Smithy, which is a name that Hollywood directors are authorized to use if they don't want their name on a film. Well, a few years, about a year and a half or 2 years later, they finally brought out another version of Dune that was the original length, which was over 4 hours, and then David Lynch put his name back on it. And that was a classic, and it still is. It runs and runs, and it'll run forever. Now, this is the same thing, I think, what happened with John Carter. What we have is a huge story here, recovering three novels. Same thing that happened with Dune, because Dune is not just the first book. Dune is the first three books of the Dune series were put together in that David Lynch, original David Lynch film. Now, the same thing here has happened to John Carter. They had planned a three-deck series. Somehow or other, as they continued into this thing, more and more of this got squeezed into one film. So the result is the plot of John Carter, the movie, is very difficult to follow. And the film's beautiful. It's beautifully done. It's magnificent to watch. It totally carries you away. But you have difficulty, unless you really know what's going on, you have difficulty following it. Now, it doesn't matter. The film still should have been successful in the United States. There were several things that went wrong and several things that were done, I think, almost on purpose. And one of the things that was just about, it was almost perverted, was the prologue to the film in the United States. The prologue for John Carter in the film, it opens up and you see the planet Mars on the screen as if you're maybe 150,000 miles out, maybe, that fills the whole screen. And then you start moving in on it. And a narrator tells you that you don't know Mars. He says, you think you know Mars, but you don't. And all of a sudden, we're swooping in on the Martian desert, and we find ourselves in the middle of an air battle between a fleet of Martian airships, and they're shooting at each other, and this is this very very well done, but it's it It's completely incongruous to what we think we know about Mars, or Americans at least. I mean, hell, this is a dead. NASA's been telling us over and over and over again, oh, this is nothing but a desert, bunch of money, but sandy rock pile. That's all it is. The air can't breathe it, can't do it. There's nothing there, and we can't find anything, and all, and this is on and on. And here, all of a sudden, we're in the middle of this very high-tech air battle between aerial warships. And then we get this magical the high priest giving one of these Martian princes a magical weapon, and all of this is going on, and it is just absolutely, it's not only is it a spoiler, and you know, it spoils the film, but they're shooting their wad right at the beginning of this thing and showing you what they should be leading up to. And this prologue doesn't work at all. And the professional screenwriters would never, a professional screenwriter would never do a thing like this. And the reason is that a professional screenwriter, and I have to admit I am one, that you know that the rule is you have the audience completely at your disposal for the first 30 minutes of the film. 25 to 30 minutes of the film, you can do anything you want. You have to, between 25 and 30 minutes into the film, you have to give them something exciting. You have to give them a surprise, something exciting. It's called the first act hook. But up to that time, you got them trapped. They paid their ticket. They're in the audience. And you can lead up slowly. You can prepare them for it. They've got to have that big one in 25 or 30 minutes. And yet, in this bollocked up, poorly edited version of this John Carter, which should have been three movies, all squeezed in, they do this in the beginning, makes no sense at all, and it spoils, to an extent, it spoils it ruins the aesthetic distance. Aesthetic distance is a theatrical term, which means getting you into the mood, taking you into the dream state, so you can really be in the film, so you can, it makes it more believable. And in this particular case, this should have been done and would have been done if they had left this prologue out. Prologue should be cut out and thrown away. And yet, so why was it ever put in there? As if somebody wanted to ruin the film in the United States. Now, then on top of that, we had the problem with this horrible advertising campaign. Nobody knew what the film was about. People couldn't figure out whether it was about Greek mythology and what's a guy named John Carter doing in ancient Greece and what are these creatures we can't see. We're seeing them through a fog and we don't know what they are. And nobody in the previews were so ambiguous that you couldn't figure anything out. So it was almost as if this advertising campaign, nobody wanted anybody to know what it was they were going to see, and the result was they stayed away in droves. Now, not only that, but the critics, of course, who were able to screen the film beforehand.
Disney held on to it right up to about a week before the release, and then they released it for the critics.
And the critics all ganged up on it, and they all decided that they were going to trash it. And then when it opened, they were saying before it had ever opened, they said it's going to fail.
Oh, it's going to fail. And then it opened. Oh, it's failing. And they wouldn't even give it a chance. And then fail, fail, fail. Everybody said it's going to fail. Oh, it's a flop. And of course, as far as box office is concerned, it was. this was a $250 million movie, and it grossed something like $72 million in the United States. Oh boy! But it made money in China, like, and it broke all box office records in Russia, and it did very well in Latin America, and it so something was going on here. Now, I think one of the reasons why it did fail, and this gets us around to Richard Hoagland, who I think, those of you who follow this sort of thing, you know, Richard Hoagland's a former NASA scientist, and he has been, since he's left NASA, he has been on a campaign to reveal that there's all kinds of information about Mars and the moon, too, that NASA has withheld they haven't withheld it, they've distorted it, they've buried it, and they've misinterpreted it on purpose and all of that. And Hoagland has been pointing this out. Hoagland, if you recall, was very much in favor of the idea of declaring that face, that what appears to be a human face, a huge human face carving in the Cydonia region of Mars. And Hoagland jumped on that, and he said, well, hey, you know, that's a face. And it looks kind of like Egyptian, and it looks like the Sphinx and whatever. Well, he did a lot of work on that. And finally, NASA went back and took another clearer picture of it. And maybe, and you look at the clearer picture from a different angle, that face doesn't look so much like a face, but then the berm, the revetment around the whole mountain, because it's a whole mountain, actually, it has a rectangular revetment, which is a giant berm, actually. And that berm is even more detailed in the second photograph. And you know, regardless of whether this is a face or not, now we want to know who built the berm. Who built this big revetment? You know, what's going on here? This is just one example of many, many, many anomalies that actually have been photographed by NASA. And, you know, I'm not going to spend too much time talking about the trees on Mars and the vegetation on Mars and the water on Mars and all the rest of the, and the atmosphere on Mars and all of that, because, frankly, if you don't think I'm, if you think I'm exaggerating, then I think you ought to do an internet search yourself and look at all the evidence that's on the internet about this, and I think you'll realize that what I'm saying is true. Now, but Doug Kenyon in Atlantis Rising, this issue, May, June 2012, has a wrap-up article on all of this called True Mars, and this is by William B. Stoker. And it's different sources have different stories as to what really what's really on the red planet. And this is a good wrap up of the various anomalies, which you will find in the an internet search. One of the things you will realize if you really dig into this is that NASA has recolored several of the rover photographs to give the impression that the atmosphere is less developed than it apparently is. They've recolored the photographs so that the sky is not blue. They did not, however, recolor the photographs so that the sky would be as dark as it would be if Mars didn't have the atmosphere, and they're trying to tell us that Mars doesn't have the atmosphere. But then what have we got a white sky for? Huh? Yeah. But the white sky is actually a distortion, a color distortion of a real blue sky.
And actually, the sky on Mars is just as blue as it is here on Earth. And I think you know what that means. And also, there are artifacts, and some of the NASA photographs of the artifacts, standing statues and carvings, and you know, some of these are absolutely amazing. And yet, they're buried in NASA files, and then they've never been commented on, and we continually are told that, there's no life on Mars, or we haven't found any, and we're looking for microbes, and we can't find them, and we're looking for water, and we're not sure that it's there, and all of this. Well, there's a lot of water on Mars, not, you know, oceans, but, I mean, there's reservoirs, and there's water on Mars. And there's vegetation on Mars, too. In fact, certain photographs that are in true color show green vegetation areas that do follow the seasons. And, of course, we know they have polar caps. But up until just recently, we were told that that polar ice was all carbon dioxide. I mean, we've had more disinformation in the United States about what's really going on Mars than anywhere else in the world. And you wonder why the American space program, where we were the leaders in space, and that helped our economy tremendously. All of this, our microchip leadership in microelectronics is all derived from the space program. You wonder why the American economy is in the doldrums, and why we are losing world prestige, and why we are way down. It's because one of the reasons is we haven't kept up the space program. We let it go. You know, sure, I'm talking to you from Hawthorne, and hey, this is Rocket City. This is the only place we're making rocket ships anymore. Is you're an author. We got a little company here that makes them, and we finally sent one up to the International Space Station, but the big stuff and everything else goes on Russian rockets. And our space program is it's an eclipse. Why is that? Why, if we want to have jobs, if we want to really recover our country's economy and prestige, why have we given up the space program? We need to ask ourselves that question. And that's part of the reason, I think, why the film John Carter here in this country, why it was almost engineered to fail. Because if it had been properly edited, if it had been properly advertised, if it had been properly released, the film would have been a success in this country, but it would also have generated interest in the real Mars. And it seems that I'm not going to say the government, let's just say whoever it is that wants the American people not to know things. And there's a lot of things that the American people aren't supposed to know. And whoever these people are who want the American people not to know things decided that we really shouldn't be watching this film. This film should not become popular, because if it does become popular, first thing you're going to say is, well, hey, I wonder if Mars really is as desolate and as dead as we've been told it is. And pretty quickly and pretty soon we'd find out it wasn't. And that seems to be one of the reasons why this film, which the people who made it, they loved it. They wanted it to be successful. They tried it, but somehow or other it got, and especially that horrible prologue. That prologue right off the bat was enough to kill the film, at least in this country. Now, I'm not sure whether that Prolon was even attached to it in other countries. I'd be interested to find out whether or not whether that Prolon was available only in this country or whether it wasn't. I don't know. But in other countries like Russia and China and all, where they know more about Mars than and they haven't been propagandized like we have, maybe the Prolon wouldn't have been that bad. The Prolon wouldn't hurt that much. So maybe the Prolon stayed with the film. But in any case, any way you look at it, the Prolon was wrong. One of the things that we talked about Hoagland here with his theories, and Hoagland agrees there has been a serious effort to suppress this film in the United States. Hoagland agrees with that. One thing that I want to mention, though, a little correction on Hoagland is Hoagland said that he thought that Burroughs had placed his Empire of Helium right in the same position on Mars that Cydonia, where the face is, and that's not correct. Burroughs placed Helium in the southern hemisphere, and Cydonia in the northern hemisphere, and so it's halfway around the planet in the southern hemisphere, but what Burroughs did place right where the face is the ruined Martian city of Horz, H-O-R-Z, Horz. That's right smack where the face and the complex on Mars are located. Now, Hoagland probably didn't have access to Burroughs' original map of Mars. Burroughs was very meticulous. Burroughs planned out his Martian books very, very carefully. He did a map, a two-hemisphere map of Mars with all the latitude and longitude meridians all set up and mapped the whole thing. It's kind of a crude map, but it's very, very meticulous. Now, Burroughs also, for all of his pulp fiction action style that he did, Burroughs was a very good amateur anthropologist. And Burroughs, when he created these various cultures, and he had a chance on Mars to just really have a lot of fun creating these different cultures, he used various earthly models. Now, the model that he used for the Martian red men, or the red race on Mars, that's the race that you of humanoids. In the film John Carter, you'll very quickly run into the green Martians. They're about 9 feet tall, and they have forearms and tusks, and they're green, and they're very, very savage. But like most savages, they're very manneristic, and they have a very formal culture. But they're barbarians. And then you have a more civilized race, the red race, and they're humanoid. They still lay eggs and live for 1,000 years if they're lucky. But their culture is based upon Japanese samurai, medieval Japanese samurai culture. And Burroughs is very good about that. He really, really was an amateur. He didn't have a degree in anthropology, but a good amateur anthropologist. And so in the original story, of course, John Carter, and in the movie, John Carter lands on Mars, and he's way out in the desert, and he lands on Mars, and it takes him, oh, gosh, it takes him a whole day just to learn how to walk, because the gravity is so different that he's bouncing around and Ben Fahmy, resident of the Green Warriors, the Green Farks, and they adopt him, teach him the language, and his jumping ability makes him quite a
curiosity among them, and then that of course gives him excellent fighting ability. Because he can jump right over somebody's head and land behind them and whack their head off at the same time. So he gains quite a reputation as a warrior very, very quickly on.
And what I want to mention here is that the Martians, both the Green Martians and the Red Martians, the humanoids, they lay eggs and they live. Their lifespan is actually about 1,000 years, but most of them never live that long because they're a warrior culture, both the green and the red men, and they fight duels and they have a lot of assassinations and all this sort of thing, so they don't live usually to 1,000 years. Now, one of the things that explaining about the books. The villains in this whole series are the Therns, and the Therns are these mysterious priests who have magical powers. And on the film, they have their magical powers even more so than they do in the book. But the Therns have temples in all the Martian cities, and they also, the Green Men also venerate them. But the Therns do actually have a cult where they're controlling the population, which this is the books also and the film. And what they do is they mandate a pilgrimage down this river called Issus, that runs down into a cavern. And when you reach 1,000 years of age, if you haven't been killed off by then, you're supposed to take this pilgrimage. And you go down this river, and when you get through the cavern, you're supposed to find yourself in paradise. Well, that's not what happens. What happens is, as you get through the river, through the cavern, and you end up being eaten by the plant men. And if there's anything left over from the plant men, then the white apes are going to get you. And if the white apes don't get you, the Therns will make a slave out of you. And then if the Therns get tired of you, they'll eat you because they're cannibals. So this is all done to control the population. Because if the Martians are virtually immortal, the planet, being a dying planet, it can only sustain a very fixed population. And so the Therns are the villains, but at least they are trying to control the population. But they are, and this is in the original books now. Well, now what they did in the screenplay, which was brilliant, really brilliant, and also might have been some reason why the film was suppressed, possibly, if you want to believe in the Philadelphia experiment and that sort of stuff, like our friend Andrew Basago does, then possibly the ingenious idea that Stanton and his confederates had about combining Carter's jump to Mars with the whole concept of the Therns. Now, in the books, the Therns had these medallions. If you were a first-level Thern on the top priests, you had this medallion, as a very elaborate medallion. Well, but in the screenplay, this medallion becomes Stargate. And the way Carter gets from his cave in Arizona to Mars is he finds a Thern in the back of a cave, and he wrestles with the Thern, and he kills the Thern and takes the medallion and boom, the medallion starts to light up, and off he goes. And now the ferns are, according to the screenplay, the ferns are on Earth, and they have secret. They're secretly on Earth, and they have various caves, and all. It's very much like our interdimensional convergence points in Beyond Lemuria, if you've seen that. And the third medallion is very much like our intergravitron in Beyond Lemuria. This is a window to a vortex to jump to another planet. Now, this could very easily be also a time travel device, because if you're going to jump the continuum like this, you're also very, very probably going to jump dimensions. And if you jump dimensions, you can also jump time. So the Therns can act like Doctor Who. I mean, they could go back and forth in time. So it's quite possible that you could have Carter jumping to a Mars that was 50,000 years ago. That's possible. They don't say that, but that would be possible with this concept. But the Thern medallion, which is very beautifully done in the film, by the way, I'd love to have one of these Thern medallion replicas if they ever come up with one. These medallions are, as I say, it's a stargate. And this is a beautiful concept. And it's a beautiful concept, but it's also something that is, according to some people, a very, very distinct possibility. This harkens back to the Philadelphia experiment. And Andrew Basago has some very interesting thoughts on that. And I think we're going to try to see if we can get Andrew Basago on the show to talk about some of these things at a future date. He couldn't right now because he's on tour, but we will hopefully be able to get him on and talk about this sort of thing specifically. But this idea of being able to jump the continuum like this is I'm not saying this is why one of the reasons why the film was suppressed. I don't think that's it. I think the real reason why the film was suppressed in this country was that they really don't want people to become fascinated with Mars. And if this film was as successful as it could have been, or as it was overseas, it would have generated a lot of interest in the planet Mars. And I don't know. Maybe that sounds too much like a conspiracy. But there are a lot of things about this that just don't add up. Because the film, even with its bad editing, and even with the fact that they squeezed all this together so that the plot, even if you are as deeply into the whole John Carter series as I've been, even so, and I read all three books over again before I saw the film, and I even had, of course, I'm a little hard of hearing, so sometimes when they're mumbling, I can't quite tell, but I had a little trouble following some of it, but then I thoroughly enjoyed it, except for that terrible prologue. But the point being that this film could have been, even as squeezed up as it was, even taking three whole films and trying to squeeze them into 2 hours, even so, this should have been a real success in this country. And why it wasn't, and why it was so poorly handled, why that's the question that raises the issue, and why the critics all ganged up. They were all set. But even before they saw it, even before they saw the film, they were all cocked and loaded to pan the film. And then when it was released, they told people, the day it was released, they told people it was going to fail. They didn't even wait. They didn't wait for, to see whether it would or not. They jumped on it right away and said, it's failing, it's failing. It's going to fail, it's failing, it failed. You know, I mean, it's, in fact, some of the people commented that. Some of the people commenting on the reviews, they wondered why in the Dickens is this thing going down the way it is. And so I'll read you a comment here on this. This is a comment from one of the viewers. It says, I couldn't believe reading Wednesday and Thursday before the release about how it was going to fail, and during the weekend that it was failing, and of course now that it had failed. The critics wanted it to, and I don't think that it's failure. Because it didn't gross $100 million the first weekend, and it was on my list of things. Yeah, and then another fellow says, "Well, I must agree." He said, "It's going to fail. It's failing. It failed." Talk, and that's, you know, I think the critics have had a death wish on this movie, and have been smashing both John Carter for so long now that it has a negative attention, and in other words, there was apparently a concentrated effort to put it down. This is a shame, and I hope that when the DVD comes out, that we can look at it again and look at it in the context of the story that it represents and the tradition that it represents, and take a new assessment of it. You know, and it's beautifully done. The film is beautifully produced, Lynn Collins, who plays Deja Thoris, she is terrific. Now, the cast is really good. I mean, and the Thurns are very convincing. They're scary. And the film has a lot of nostalgia to it. And it really, as I recall from back when I was 14 years old and reading these books, it captures that magic. And that's what Stanton and the people that did the film, that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to capture that original magic. And they did it. And even with all the problems they had and all of the things that got in their way, they still managed to do that. So this is my thoughts on it. And I'm not working for Walt Disney or anything like that, but I really encourage you to get the DVD and look at it. Look at the film and without all the hype and all the people telling you not to like it. And just look at the film as an American classic. And I think that you'll really enjoy it. Now, next week, we are going to deal with a man that I am proud to have known, and you know, I knew Israel Regardi, and I also knew Manly Hall, and I didn't know Manly Hall as well as I knew Israel Regardi, but I did know Manly Hall. In fact, I had the honor of sponsoring him at our Masonic Lodge in the old Scottish Rite Cathedral way back when. And so next week we are going to have a show on Mighty Manly Hall and the book that we're going to use as a centerpiece for our show on Manly Hall will be Master of the Mysteries by Lewis Sahagan, and we'll see if we can find him. We'll see if he can call in. But we'll talk about Manly Hall and his work and his accomplishments and his mysterious, somewhat sinister demise. That's the master of the mysteries is a mystery in itself. And so we're looking forward to that next week. And meanwhile, good magic.